Thank you very much. Thanks to the organizers for this amazing workshop or conference. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend, as Celine mentioned, but I was also sick in the past 3 days, so I had to miss most of the talks. And I apologize for my voice, and there may be some little interruptions. So let me start. I'm going to talk about the celestial charges and vacuum transition in gravity. This is based on collaborations with Luc Blanchet, Geoffrey Comper, Guillaume Fay, and Roberto Oliveri in these two papers that I mentioned here. But it is also highly inspired by some works by Laurent Friedel, Daniele Pranzetti, and Anna Maria Raclario, and also a paper by David Nichols and Alex Grant. I just wanted to mention these two nice papers. As a motivation, let me talk about gravitational memory effects. So this is a very nice feature of gravity, which is that the gravitational wave is not a purely oscillatory waveform, but it contains a non-oscillatory piece that builds up over time and leads to a final offset in the waveform. And this has observable consequences. For example, if you look at the distance between two test masses in the far zone, because of the oscillation, there will be some change in the distance. And I mean, there is a permanent change in the distance between the particles. So this is the classical example of gravitational wave memory effects, which is known since 70s. And there are many interesting works by different people mentioned here. But there are also some recent very interesting activities in this field. For example, there is this spin memory effect by Strömger and collaborators, but also the recent work that I've done with Blagojev Black on gyroscopic memory effect. So these are basically, just to briefly mention, the spin memory is some interferometry experiment, and the effect of gravitational wave is some change in the phase of this interferometry. But the gyroscopic memory is closely related to that, but not exactly the same thing. But here, the thing is that if you have a freely falling gyroscope and the gravitational wave passes through this system, there is a net change of orientation in the gyroscope. And this captures very important information about the memory in the gravitational waveform, which is not the same as this memory in the first case. It's a different type of data. So there was this very interesting work by Strominger that showed that there is this triangular relation between memory effects, asymptotic symmetries, and soft theorems. What I want to stress in this talk is that the simple fact that there is this asymptotic symmetry group for gravity implies that the gravitational vacuum, which I will define more precisely later, is not a single vacuum, but there is actually a space of vacua involved, and a radiative process leads to a transition between this vacua. So you start with some vacuum, there is some dynamics in the system, and you end up with a different vacuum. So this we call a vacuum transition. And this is somehow the basis for this memory effect. So there are two natural questions that we can ask here. One is that what is the non-degenerate description of the vacua? Or in other words, how to label the vacua in a unique way? or if you want, a coordinate system on the space of Vakua, and a somewhat equivalent question is that what is the largest set of asymptotic charges that you can associate to gravitational systems? So in my talk, I'm going to somehow elaborate on these questions. So let me start by talking about celestial charges. And I should mention that this is Laura and previous talks in the context of asymptotically flat spacetimes. So in this context, it's very useful to choose a Bondi coordinate system consisting of a retarded time u, a radial distance r, and angular coordinates theta a, where a is one or two angles on the sphere. And Bondi gauge is these conditions in which the general metric takes this form. While details are not important, I will mention anything that I need for my talk. So you, on top of that, you have a boundary condition, which is that the angular part of the metric asymptotes to a given metric on the celestial sphere. And with this metric, you define a connection. Now, the determinant condition in the Bondi gauge implies that you can write down the angular part of the metric in this elegant form. So you decompose this GAB into the trace part and the trace-free part. This calligraphic C is a trace-free, symmetric trace-free tensor, which depends on all coordinates. Now we use the asymptotic expansion in powers of 1 over r, and the quantities that appear in the metric, these scalars f and beta, vector ua on the sphere, and this tensor gab on the sphere are expanded asymptotically in this form. We expand asymptotically because we are interested in asymptotic phenomena in the large distance. So when you do the asymptotic expansion, you have a bunch of important quantities. So this SDF quantity CAB is expanded into normal CAB. This is the usual shear tensor, Bondi shear, which is actually the gravitational waveform. But you also have subleading components. So these quantities now depend only on angles and the retarded time, so because the R is now explicit. Then you also have this quantity M, which is called the Bondi mass aspect. And here in the TA component of the metric, you will have this quantity NA, which is the angular momentum aspect. So why are these important? Because these are actually the Bondi free data. What do I mean by that? So the thing is that you can, if you try to solve the equations, starting from null infinity and going inwards, so the data that you are free to specify is, first of all, this CAB, the Bondi shear, as a function of time and angles. And on top of that, you have a set of corner degrees of freedom, corner quantities. So this relates my talk to the subject of this conference. So the corner quantities, which are only functions of angle, now are the mass aspect, angular momentum aspect, and these subleading quantities EAB. So the EAB ends are the coefficients of the power of r to the minus n in the expansion of this SDF tensor, which appeared in the GAB angular component of the metric. So you have these free data. And these are given at some given initial instant of time, k. can be somehow the past of future null infinity or some given initial cut at scribe plus. Then the so-called Niels tensor is actually the time derivative of the shear, and it is a measure of radiation. So when NAB, the Niels tensor, is zero, you're talking about a non-radiative space-time. And this is important in the rest of the talk. But so we have this corner data. The time evolution of these quantities, mass aspect, NA and EABN, are given by a set of balance, so-called balance equations. An example of these balance equations is this famous equation for the mass aspect. So the time evolution of the mass aspect, now as a function of time and angles, is given by these two terms. So there is a linear term in the Niels, usually called a soft term, soft flux, and there is this quadratic term in the Niels, which is the hard flux. And from this, you can show that the energy is always decreasing, for example. So as I said, when the Niels is zero, the space-time is non-radiative. So you see that the right-hand side of this equation is zero in this case. And therefore, in non-radiative spacetimes, M is a conserved quantity. Now, this is one example of the balance equation. We have an equation for each of these quantities, these corner quantities. And this is the list of the full list of balance equations. This was derived in this paper by Grant and Nichols. And as you see, the structure, I mean, there are details which are not important, but the structure is very interesting. So you have the time derivative of your Bondi data, M, NA, EAB, with index N, which is equal to some flux FAB. These are the hard fluxes, and the soft flux, which is written on the left hand side of the equation, has this nice structure that it is u to the power n times some angular derivative of the Niels. So we will use this structure later. But notice that these calligraphic NA and EAB are some improved versions of the NA and EAB, which appears in the metric. And as you see, so these fluxes are built in a way that they are zero when the Niels is zero. And therefore, as you see from these equations, all the Bondi data are conserved in non-radiative spacetimes. So using this fact, we can actually define a set of two towers of charges, which I call the celestial charges. This is an extension of BMS charges. So on the first line, you have, so you see that the charge has a label, it has two labels, Q of N and phi. So phi is an arbitrary function on the sphere. So you smear your bonded data with some quantity derived from this phi, integrated over the sphere. And this defines for you the charges. So for example, this first one is Q0 phi is the Bondi supermomenta. And the second one is the so-called dual supermomenta. Then on the second line, you have the super angular momenta and super center of mass. These correspond to the diffus two symmetries of the generalized BMS. And then on the third line, you have these charges that are defined from this subleading bonded data. And these are actually related to the higher spin charges that was defined and discussed by Friedel and collaborators. So the point is that, okay, now if you want, you can expand this this function phi on the sphere into spherical harmonics, and then you will have a charge q plus minus n comma l. So l is the multiple moment, and then n is the order in this subleading this tower. Okay, so this is what I call the celestial charges. Now, as I mentioned, you have, I mean, a non-radiative space-time is given by the bonded data, which are conserved independent of time. And as it is clear from these expressions, you can actually invert these equations, and you can reconstruct a non-radiative space-time by knowing the celestial charges. There is a little subtlety here, which is that there is an ambiguity because of the supertranslation frame, because as you know, the action of a supertranslation. So if you decompose the bonded shear into electric parity part and the electric the magnetic parity part, these two scalars, C plus and C minus, the electric part is ambiguous up to supertranslations, and this so. The C minus part is actually fixed by dual supermomenta, but the C plus part is unconstrained by the celestial charges. I mean, the celestial charges don't give you any information about this C plus. And this is because of this supertranslation ambiguity. If you want, you can use supertranslations to set this C plus to zero in your non-radiative space time. All what I'm talking about in this slide is about non-radiative spacetimes. Okay, so this is about the reconstruction. Now let's talk about radiation and vacuum transition. So in this talk, what I have in mind is what I call a sandwich spacetime, which is that you have so this is future null infinity, and you have your new tensor actually decays exponentially outside some time interval. So it means that before some retarded time, your space time is non-radiative. Then there is radiation in some time interval, and then you go back to a non-radiative space time. And now, for me, a non-radiative space-time, I'll call it a radiative vacuum, because there is no graviton in these regions of the space-time. So I'll call it a radiative vacuum, or simply a vacuum. So I'm considering space-times that is in vacuum state before and after radiation. And as I mentioned before, the vacua are completely characterized by the celestial charges, Q and L. There is plus minus missing here. And moreover, because of this radiation, it's not clear that the initial vacuum and the final vacuum are identical. Indeed, it turns out that in general, they're different. And therefore, the vacuum transition is specified completely by this change in the celestial charges. And this change in the celestial charges is controlled by the flux balance equations. So let's talk about the flux balance equations. Let me just check my time. Okay, so these are the list of balance equations I mentioned before. You can integrate over time. You see that here you have u to the n times the nums. So if you integrate over time, you have this nice structure that you see that there is the Mellin transform of the nums with integer label n appears here in the linear term. And on the left-hand side, you will have the change in your Bondi data. And then you will also have these nonlinear fluxes. From this, you can infer the change in your celestial charges, and the result, after doing the math, you find that the change in the charge is given by these expressions. So you see the Mellin transform of the nums here integrated over the sphere with some spherical harmonic, and there is this nice product here, which is important for my discussion. You see that this is a product from k from 0 to n minus 1 of k, k plus 1 minus l, l plus 1. So if k is equal to l, if there is l in this sum, in this product, if it happens that k is equal to l, then this is vanishing. So let's see what is the consequence of this. But yeah, so as I mentioned, in the vacuum transition given by this change in the charges, there appears the Mellin transform of the nums and the nonlinear fluxes of hard gravitons. So because of this fact I mentioned about vanishing of the product, the set of flux balance equations actually split into two subsets. One set is the memory full balance equations, by which I mean the case where the soft term is non-zero, the linear term in the nums is non-zero. In this case, the way that you should look at this equation is that the memory or the soft piece is written as the change in the charge minus the hard fluxes. So this is actually an equation that relates memory effects to this vacuum transition and this this radiation. Or in other words, the soft sector of the theory, which is given by this memory or the soft term, adapts itself to the hard process in a way that the conservation equations or the flux equations are satisfied. And this is why these equations are useful to derive the memory. But there is another set, which is the memory-less balance equations, which is the case in which the soft term vanishes. In this case, there is no memory, and the change in the charge is equal to the hard flux. And this equation should be actually useful for radiation, to quantify radiation reaction effects. And this is this is in principle very useful for gravitational wave theory. And so this is a picture of these two equations. In one case, you have these soft terms that make the change, the difference. So in more precisely, the memory-less modes are actually the whole set of Poincaré charges for n equals 0 and n equal 1 for these values of L. Then for n equal 2, there is no memory-less mode. For n equal 3 and L equal 2, you have the Newman-Penrose charges. These are the five complex charges or 10 real charges. And then for n higher than 3, you will have, for this range of L, you will have, if you want, generalized Newman-Penrose charges. And as I said, these are useful for radiation reaction. applications. If you want to see some application of these flux balance equations in the context of gravitational wave theory, you can look at, I mean, there is a large literature, but you can look at these papers. But the memoryful modes includes for n equals zero, L larger than two, this gives the displacement memory. N equal one gives the spin and center of mass memory. And then higher n will correspond for L larger than n, correspond to subleading memory effects. These are, we don't know much about these possible observable effects of this. The only thing that we know so far is the curve deviation memory that is recently derived by Alex Grant and David Nichols. And this is somehow a generalization of the notion of geodesic deviation. You can look at the paper. Okay, so I don't know how much time do I have, can you?
5 more minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Okay, then let me try to quickly do this last part. So there is another way to discuss about this this vacuum transition in these celestial charges, which relates this celestial charges to multiple moments and what we call multiple charges. So to do that, let me talk about briefly, quickly about the Post-Minkowskian approach. So you start from harmonic gauge, which is given in terms of this gothic metric perturbation like this. And then in this gauge, the Einstein equation takes this nice form. On the left-hand side, you have the box of H. So box is the Lambertian over Minkowski background. And H is this gothic metric perturbation. Then the right-hand side, which is the source, it involves the stress tensor of the matter plus some non-linear combinations of the metric perturbation. Then you solve this. First of all, you make the post-Minkowskian expansion, I mean, expansion powers of the Newton constant of this perturbation, and then you solve this equation order by order. At leading order, you have two equations to satisfy, and you can show that the solution, the canonical solution, I mean, optic gauge transformation, is given by this expression, which, as you see, is specified completely by these two sets of multiple moments, which are called the mass multiples and the spin multiples. And these capital L's are, I mean, this is a multi-index notation, and these are only functions of the return time. Then you can do a transformation from harmonic gauge to Bondi gauge. This we have done in this paper with Blanchet and others. And you can read off the Bondi data. For example, you can see that the Bondi shear is given by this expression. And what is important here is that in the shear, what appears is the L time derivative of the mass multiple and the L time derivative of the spin multiple. So this superscript refers to the number of time derivatives. Now, if you think about a non-radiative spacetime, the news is zero. News is the time derivative of the shear. And for this to be zero, you should have the L plus one time derivative of these two quantities to be zero. And this implies that in a non-radiative space-time, the mass and the spin multiples are given as a polynomial in powers of U from zero to L for the Lth multiple moment. And these coefficients are now just constants. So in other words, a non-radiative spacetime is fully characterized by what we call multiple charges, which are these actually these coefficients MLK and SLK for k between 0 and L. Now you can move further and compute all the Bundy data starting from the Poisson-Minkowskian solution. At linear order, you find that the mass aspect, angular momentum aspect, and these subleading aspects are given by these expressions. And then from there, you can actually compute the celestial charges at leading order. And what you find is that this very simple expression, which shows that the celestial charges are actually directly related to the what we call the multiple charges, these coefficients MLK, if you want. And this is explicit, and these A's are just numerical coefficients. So this is for the case where L is larger than N. For L less than N, these are the Neumann-Penrose charges, and we see that at linear order, Neumann-Penrose charges are just zero. So as I said, this shows the equivalence between celestial charges and multiple charges. So let me just summarize future work, which is that it would be nice to go to nonlinear order, second order, for example, in the Poisson-Minkowskian approximation, and compute these Neumann-Penrose or generalized Neumann-Penrose charges, see how they look like, and to see if these balance equations and these memory-less balance equations have implications for like binary systems. So we are, we are working on this with these people, and there appears soon a paper. Then there is another issue, which is that this sandwich model of space-time is actually not a very precise description because of the so-called gravitational tail effects. So the tail effects imply that the late time behavior of the shear is like this expression. So you have some different powers of 1 over u starting from n equal 1. This leads to some poles in these integer Mellin transforms of the news which appears in the balance equations. So we have to understand this better. Perhaps there's a renormalization process involved and so on in the definition of charges. Then finally, there is an interesting discussion about gravitational electric magnetic duality. So we know that at linear order, you can realize the duality in the gravitational action, which was done in this paper by Hannu and Teitelboim. And the definition of the duality is given by this duality of the Weyl tensor. But you can show that at linear order, this duality corresponds to sending the mass multiple moment into the spin multiple moment in this way. And also equivalently, you can think of it as sending the shear to the dual shear. And the dual shear is just a contraction of the epsilon, the Levi-Civita tensor with the shear. So these are all equivalent at linear order, but it will be interesting to see how they change at nonlinear order. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Ali, to give your talk, even though you're sick. So we have time for a couple of questions.
Hi, Ali. Thank you for your talk. I have a question about this tail effect and how people in numerical relativity deal with it. My understanding is that in numerical relativity, they're dealing with the sandwich model you describe. Correct? Like when it's numerical simulation, somehow they kind of they put these tails into the noise of their.
I'm not. I don't know. Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, I mean, they have many truncations and approximations. So, yeah, I don't know exactly if they see and how they see these tail effects, or if they just ignore it.
Or maybe it's more a comment about the sandwich model. So when people model, the merging of black hole before, there's nothing, and after, so there's nothing. So these tails are like some, more subtle effects that are beneath
Yeah,
the
so I
dominant
think that,
signal or.
right. These are somehow far zone effects. So if you just concentrate on the near zone effect, okay, of course, the two black holes just merge into a single black hole, which is stationary, and that's done. But when you look at the large distance and large time, there are somehow gravitons that are scattering backwards, and this actually leads to these tail effects. And I'm not sure exactly how this is dealt with in the numerical context. But again, the way that we look at this is within the context of post-Minkowskian, post-Newtonian, post-Minkowskian approximation, which is also an approximation scheme. And could be that there is a problem with this perturbation theory at large time. So for the moment, I don't have a precise statement, but one has to look at this more carefully, because this is a trouble for all these celestial higher spin charges.
Massimo?
Yes, so memories and soft modes exist also in electrodynamics, right? They are not specific to gravity. If they do exist, these higher charges in the case of electromagnetism?
Yes. I think you can do the same game in electrodynamics. And yeah, this expansion which I showed before for the Bondi. Sorry. Just a second. Yeah, so this subleading expansion, if you want, the transverse part of the metric contains these quantities. In case of Maxwell, it will be the similar here. So you take the gauge field, it will have a transverse component A. So you have A mu, you have AA, which are the angular components. And then you expand in powers of 1 over R, you will have some subleading data, which will follow a similar pattern. But I've not studied that carefully. But I think, I guess Miguel Campiglia has a paper on that. But yeah, I think there can be similar. But the point is that here, I mean, Maxwell is a linear theory. This is not linear. And I mean, this makes this memory effects more interesting, because the radiation itself can cause some additional effect in the radiation, which is this nonlinear memory. And I think this makes it more interesting in this case.
Just a quick last question by Luis.
Sorry, this is not a question, just a comment on the tail question of Florent and the answer. So it depends on the context. There are numerical simulations, say, of binary black holes. Because the boundary is sufficiently close, the tails are typically buried under the noise. But there are plenty of applications where you see the main, if you want, quasi-normal phase that leads into the tails, and they are measured. Of course, you can't go that deep as far as the L power is concerned, but the first few are comfortably extracted in those contexts.
Thank you very much. Thanks Ali again for giving his talk.
Thank you very much.